You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you. Anymore with doctrinal stuff. You've had enough thrown at you, and I think I've offered you the basis for understanding judicial power and how and why we do what we do. We talked about Dred Scott, but I try to talk to you about it in terms of how we as a people now are turning to return to courts to resolve our issues. Failed in 1857 dismally. That didn't stop us from continuing to do it. I tell you, one of my favorite moments, I have a whole thesis about how what I call legislative acquiescence, Congress in effect invited the courts in to rule on things. One time in 1914, Congress was making its first sortie into the field of labor law and guaranteed the right of labor to organize and bargain collectively and so forth. So, and immediately the leader of the American Federation of Labor, Samuel Gompers, called it the Magna Carta of Labor. The New York Times, in its wisdom, along with William Howard Taft, a great constitutional expert, said, No. It doesn't give them anything new. It's merely declaratory of existing law. During the debate, the House Judiciary Committee pointed out, brought in a bill, legislation, that was really very far-reaching. The Senate's was far more restrictive. And so Congress got in a big debate with itself as to what it meant. And one congressman stood up and said, one side says it means this, the other side says it means that. He says, who knows? Who will tell us? The Supreme Court will, 8, 10, 14 years from now. It took the Supreme Court only 7 years to tell them what it meant. And this was just symptomatic of the time. And it's interesting how this has evolved. It still goes on. And it still goes on, like in Jefferson's time, to have the courts as whipping boys. The courts did all this. Miranda's created more, let criminals off, and so forth. It has nothing to do with leaving off criminals. So anyhow, we've had this role of judicial power in the United States. I was going to talk about what happened during Reconstruction. It was a time where the court was supposedly under attack, but the fact is that the Republicans enhanced judicial power. They greatly increased the jurisdictional authority of the court. They passed a very technical legislation called removal of causes from state to federal courts, making it easier to take your case out of the state courts. Business communities wanted that because they regarded the state courts as hostile, and they wanted to get into the friendly environs of the federal courts. But this is all happening in the spirit. It's quite fascinating. I think it's more than you need to know. Instead, well, I don't mean that in an insulting way. I just mean that I'm not going to burden you with my pet projects. But I do want to talk about Reconstruction in one way. I made some remark earlier today that I believe that the Civil War and Reconstruction constituted a second American Revolution. Reconstruction was a time where the United States was reconstructed. Judicial power, as I said. But I want to talk just about the Constitution. I could talk about, you know, we talk about Lincoln and his enhancement of federal authority and all the economic development and so forth. Time of tremendous growth of the federal government. You know, don't forget, the federal government had not grown for 40 years because it had been stymied. The federal government, the South regarded the federal government as hostile to its interests, even when it controlled the federal government. So these things are happening. But I want to focus on one particular way, which I think you'll recognize. And that is, I want to talk about the amendments to the Constitution. Now, you know, amending the Constitution is a very difficult process. My favorite example of illustrating this to students was the Equal Rights Amendment. You know, that thing started state after state. Well, let me go back even further in time. Franklin Roosevelt, during the New Deal, when people wanted to know what he was going to do about the Supreme Court, some people said, well, we need a constitutional amendment clarifying power. Roosevelt said, don't talk to me about constitutional amendment. All you need is 1/4 plus one of the states to block it. He says, give me $5 million, it was cheap time, and I can get the requisite number of states not to go along. Well, Phyllis Schlafly showed you how that worked at the time of the Equal Rights Amendment. You know, it had gone, I think 36, 37 was the number needed to ratify. It got up to about 32, 33. And suddenly, opposition began to develop. And they beat it. They beat it. It was so harmless. And yet, you know, it was a symbolic thing. So, constitutional amendments don't come easily. Well, the Civil War period is a time where we pass these amendments that just take the Constitution and the nation in quite a different direction. Because what they all come down to is an assertion of national authority. Let's begin with the first, you know, which is just an amendment which says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist in the United States except for a person has been duly convicted, and you could incarcerate them, make them make your license plates. You can now have them go out, and cities don't have to pay to get landscaping done. They just get the prisoners in county jail to do it. It's going on around the country. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery. Fine. The irony is that in March 1861, before the Civil War breaks out, Congress had passed a new 13th Amendment in 1861, which forbade Congress to interfere with the domestic they don't use the word slavery, with the domestic institutions of a state anywhere in the United States. It was only ratified by Ohio, Maryland, and Illinois. That was the 13th Amendment. Obviously, it became irrelevant. And instead, we get an amendment that abolishes slavery. You know, you think about it. What an incredibly bold, dare I say, radical move. Do you understand with a sentence we wipe out millions of dollars of property rights in one sentence? Congress during the war, debated several times confiscation acts to confiscate southern states and so forth, but they were going to compensate them. There's not a word about compensation here. Were these people bold? You bet they were. Was that really a significant revolutionary change? You bet it was. But equally significant is the next sentence. There's paragraph 2, section 2. It says that Congress shall have the power to enforce this amendment with appropriate legislation. That seems harmless. Well, it's not. Because by saying that, what they are doing is to give to Congress a whole new body of powers. This was to enforce slavery. Well, for example, in 1866, they got into debate over the passage of a Civil Rights Act. And the question came up, did Congress have the power to interfere with this in the states? And the argument was made, oh, our authority for doing this is Section 2 of the 13th Amendment. We are enforcing a ban on slavery, and we are getting rid of all the legislation that sustained slavery. You know, whether it had been legislation for property rights or, blacks couldn't have a weapon, couldn't gather anywhere except in a church, if you want to understand why churches are the source of black ferment. It's because in slavery times they were forbidden to have an assembly more than a few people in most states. So, Section 1 and 2, they abolish slavery with a stroke of the pen, to use the old phrase, and then they grant power. Well, they passed that Civil Rights Act in 1866, but some people weren't too sure that Congress really had the authority to interfere with one civil standing within a state. So, they pass a 14th Amendment, which, standing alone, totally transforms the constitutional system in the United States. First of all, the first sentence corrects Dred Scott. Because remember, in Dred Scott, black people couldn't be citizens of the United States. So what's the first line of the 14th Amendment? All persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. It is the first time. One of the great omissions of the Constitution is there is no definition of citizenship. We got one. And before we had this movement of repealing the 14th Amendment, I remember I would always teach us and I'd say, you know, the United States has the most generous definition of citizenship. It has the most generous and the simplest definition of citizenship. It is relatively easy to become a citizen. Your test is limited. You know, you got to show good character and so forth. And, you know, historically, immigration in the United States, one of the things that's changed with immigration is, you know, I think of my own grandparents. My grandfather's proudest moment was getting his citizenship papers, which I have, and, you know, which this was his precious possession. He was so glad to be a citizen. Of course, he had nowhere to go back to, seeing the Tsar was killing people. But, you know, historically, people came to the United States and became citizens. This has changed in the last 30 years. You have a lot of people that they're not opting for citizenship. But they will have children here, and those children become citizens by dint of being dropped in a hospital here. You know, you could be flying from Tokyo to London and you have to make an emergency stop in Chicago to have a baby. And that baby, you understand, is a citizen of the United States. Well, you know, as I said before, there can be some abuses that so argument against its existence. I, for one, am very, very proud of that definition. All persons born and are naturalized citizens of the United States. And no state shall deny any person due process of law and equal protection of the laws. No person. It was understood until the Civil War that the protection of civil rights in the United States was a state matter. It's a state matter. We are transforming our law and making these national questions. We are, the expression we use is, we nationalize civil rights of the United States. That's what we do. It's an extraordinary moment. It's an extraordinary moment that we do this. Well, due process, well, no person shall lose their life, liberty, or property without due process of law. My God, you could write a couple of hundred textbooks following all the cases we've had on process of law. Generally, we understand that, you know, the state can deprive you of your life or liberty if you commit a crime, kill somebody. It could deprive you of your property if the state has a need for eminent domain, but they must compensate you. But this is certain fundamental guarantees. It's meant different things at different times. Let me say this, that in 1925, Supreme Court issues an opinion in which they make the statement that the 14th Amendment now takes all the fundamental rights that exist in the first eight. You know, the Fifth Amendment, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Those were always understood to apply only to actions of the federal government. And now, the court says in 1925, oh, the 14th Amendment now encompasses them all that. Now, the interesting thing about this, 86 years since 1925, well, you've had Supreme Court justices who have said there is no federal writ that can operate here, but no judge has ever said that the 14th Amendment failed to nationalize civil rights. We understand this. This is understood. So there are other provisions of that act, but in Section 5, they have another statement like Section 2 of the 13th Amendment. Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. The South is beginning to get the idea. And Alabama ratifies, the price of getting back in the Union was ratifying the 14th Amendment. They ratify it, but their legislature provides that Alabama, that this amendment does not confer upon Congress the power to legislate upon the political status of freedmen in the states. Oh, that was their reservation counted for nothing. You can't say, well, I accept the amendment, but I accept only this part of it. And it was a design, indeed, to alter the status of the freedmen. It was to give them equal standing in our law. The 14th Amendment has come to be used for many, many things. But it starts off as an attempt to equalize the status of blacks in the United States. Alabama simply missed the point. It was exactly that, to alter that political status. The 15th Amendment says that the right to vote shall not be abridged on grounds of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Doesn't that clearly mean to you that you couldn't deny a former slave or a black man in Ohio? You could not deny them the right to vote? The amendment is clearly passed by Congress, by the Republican Congress, to increase their majorities. By the time they passed it, they had written off the South. They were interested in the close states in the North, where a black vote would have shifted the balance. States like Ohio, Illinois, particularly in the Midwest, not even some in the East, too. States, particularly the southern states, found all kinds of ingenious ways of skirting this and denying blacks the right to vote. No question about it. Requiring the payment of poll taxes, residency, literacy requirements. Well, we're requiring that of everybody. Well, the fact is, you know, one common practice was they'd call somebody in, a black person, and say, tell me, I want you to recite Article 15 of the state constitution. No, I want you to write it out. They had to learn it. They made one mistake. They were out. They weren't asking white people to do that, though. So, you know, the 15th Amendment is opportunity lost from 1869 until 1965, because Section 2 of the 15th Amendment provided that Congress shall have the power to enforce this amendment with appropriate legislation. And in 1965, Congress passed the Voting Rights Act, which is based precisely on Section 2 of the 15th Amendment. They now mean to enforce the 15th Amendment. And so we are. Well, I was reading your local newspaper. I was reading the schedule of buses between Princeton and Bluefield. You know, you wonder, what does that have to do with any of my interests? There's this ad here, people getting on the bus. It says, the public is entitled to protection under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 64, and to notify the agency if anyone violates Title VI requirements. Shows people getting on a bus in Bluefield, I suppose, or Princeton, wherever it is. In other words, that bus company cannot deny you equal access and opportunity to that thing. If you want to see what the Civil War amendments did, there it was. I was sitting here in your lounge, and it caught my eye. You see, you find relevance everywhere. So, you know, we have this concept of equal protection of the laws. Some people stretch it, but on the whole, we like to talk about ourselves as an egalitarian society, although the gap between rich and poor only increases. That very rich man has one vote, and I have one vote. And I'm not rich. So these things fundamentally transform the United States. After these things are passed, the United States is not the same place. You may not like what the United States has become. It doesn't matter. I'm just telling you it's very different from what was. It was a national government of quite limited powers, quite a little authority, except those areas where it was granted power. And one might say you can read the history, you can read constitutional history from the time of, let's say, Marbury versus Madison onto the Civil War, and I will tell you it's a time of diminution of national power and authority, because the nation was just knotted, it was in knots because of the issue over slavery. And this affected the powers of the federal government. I told you, we couldn't get a transcontinental railroad system because the South was afraid of giving this too much influence to the North. They wanted it for themselves, and so we got no transcontinental railroad. And so the Civil War, as I told you before, in an economic sense, freed up these things, caused some change, and then we really write it into the Constitution in some interesting ways. Sometimes it's not always good. Back to your question of before, the Santa Clara County case, which declared corporations a person, comes out of a construction of the 14th Amendment. There are those who argue that whole doctrine was invented out of whole cloth. Be it was, which you saw in Citizens United, is just the newest manifestation of it all. So, that's all I have to say. Except, again, I will invite you to question me. Ask me question of information, qualification, so forth. So tell me, yes or no, do we have a living Constitution? You know the original intention of the Constitution? When you find out, tell me. I'm dying to know. Really? You know, I got up this morning, and I remembered the Scalia line about only idiots believe it. And I thought, gee, that's a good opening for all this. Unfortunately, I've beaten it over the head, but I do believe it. And it's true. Not only do I believe it, but it's true. We have a strange fetish in this country of constitutional worship. As if it were a flawless document. Don't forget, Michelle Obama, that the original Constitution sanctioned slavery in an indirect way. You know, it's the so-called Three-Fifths Compromise. You know about that. That these other persons only counted for three-fifths of a person for representation or taxation. They're three-fifths of a person. What an ingenious solution. But the Founding Fathers were getting rid of slavery. The fact is that it is true that as of 1787, slavery was a very fragile institution, very weak, in some ways on the way out. But what happened? Huh? You know it. It changed everything. It's 1810. It changed everything. John Marshall even said, yeah, there were a couple of cases that came up to the court regarding slavery. He was a slaveholder, but he was a very advanced person. He was a member of the American Colonization Society. These were dreamers who believed that, we'll just send the slaves back to this. We created the country of Liberia for slaves to be colonized over there. It didn't work, of course. But Marshall said to his colleague Joseph Story regarding dealing with slavery in cases, he said, I'm not fond of butting my head against the wall in sport. And it was a futile task. He says this in the 1830s, I believe, 20s, 1820s. But the cotton gin was already in place, and, the plantation system just grew like Topsy, to make a bad joke. You don't understand it. So, some would do. Okay. Let me ask the young lady, you know what I meant? You're giving away your age. Well, Topsy is the little girl in Uncle Tom's Cabin. And the line in there is, he just grew and grew and grew like Topsy, the other person. But this is the way the Southern system evolved after 1810. Historians have always loved to debate the question, is Civil War inevitable? I don't know. I've never understood what an alternative there was to force of arms. I don't understand. The South, was Lincoln an abolitionist when he became president? No, absolutely not. Did the South regard him as an abolitionist? Absolutely. Why? Because he exposed the expansion of slavery. Could not expand, it would die. Ergo, this is very special logic, ergo, he's an abolitionist. Well, he proved to be one. maybe he was a closet abolitionist. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed being with you. I look around, I said this to a couple of people, I always, in teaching, you always looked around to find some attentive faces to see how you were reaching people. But I singled out a couple of people earlier today, but I apologize to the rest of you because I've looked around. I had a minimum of nappers, and I don't know, I've just felt you're a very good, responsive group, and I just love being here with you. So thank you very much, okay? Thank you. Did you tell him, Bill, that at Wisconsin, it's only a standing ovation that counts? No. You know, if you hear my colleagues, they would sort of compete with each other. Who could get the biggest ovation?
Well, I want to thank you for coming. And I know that a lot of the folks here went to school here.
to Concord.
To Concord. And one of the things that I appreciate about this is there aren't, I don't believe, especially with research on the internet and the way the technology has transformed scholarship and the way that the technology has transformed writing books and those kinds of things. And very honestly, there aren't what I believe are real traditional scholars. They're just not that plentiful anymore. And
you mean
one of the
old fogies?
No, not old fogies. And I wanted to take the opportunity, the fact that we have the grant and we could do it, to give you an opportunity to see a real scholar, because they aren't that many around anymore. And I had said before he even came, when I went to graduate school, when I took his course, I just couldn't believe every day I kept hearing things I had never in my life ever even thought about before. And it was one of those things, and everybody says there's a book or a movie or a teacher or something in everybody's life that opened things up and made things happen. And for me, this is the guy that did it. And, right. And you know,
Bill, you just remember when I would teach the pornography kids.
I don't even know how to spell pornography. I was an Irish Catholic. What do I know about it? But I will say something. I told Bob Kincaid, when you were talking about the Clayton Act in 1914.
The what?
The Clayton Act in 1914 and Labor's Magna Carta. I wrote that in your class as a research paper in second semester.
Yeah, but I had already published my first article.
Well, I didn't read it. I didn't read it.
Anyway,
it's been a pleasure for me. And I'm just glad you could be.
I just
want to
say one more
like
thing. You people, terrible expression, you people, but you, ladies and gentlemen, not because I've done it, you do the most honorable and I think about one of the most important bits of work we do in a society. Unfortunately, you're not rewarded accordingly or recognized accordingly. You're recognized as some sort of evil people, you know, who have unions and things like this. One of the things about the fight in Wisconsin this year, I met ordinary people who were just appalled by this, and they just got renewed respect for teachers, you know, and what they do. I wish our system were better. I think you're good. I've always met good teachers. Your problem is working within a system and how you as an individual could innovate and reach people. And the larger we get, the less room there is for creativity and innovation. But think back on your own lives. I can think back on mine very clearly, as I said to the lady today, that my interest in history began in the fourth grade with Miss O'Brien, who taught me history and inspired that learning. I have had a raft of teachers of enormous influence. My first history professor in college was a woman. You know, that was rare. And, excuse me, she turned me on to history. I will say this. I'm an 18-year-old boy, you know, and she's sitting on the end of the table lecturing to us. Her legs were crossed. This was very hard on a young boy. And damn it, did I learn from that woman? Oh, wow. She taught me. I thought I knew some history. Oh, she opened a whole other world to me. One of the greatest pleasures I have in life, I contribute to a scholarship fund in her name. That's my payback, the little bit I can do. But, you know, teachers are, you're an amazing lot. And fight on. The good fight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good evening. We'll see you in the morning. And keep will be on at 8:30.
listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network. Listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.
Thank you.
Listening to the Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you. Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Is this thing on? It does appear to be on. That's a bonus. It's a minute and a half past the hour, and the program is beginning. This is live. It is Friday on the front porch on the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid, and I've been away for a while. We last spoke last Friday, as a matter of fact, because I've been off bringing you through the good offices of our dear friend Dr. Bill O'Brien and the PRISM, P-R-I-S-M, West Virginia 2011 Summer Academy. An absolute adventure, in American history. And it has been nothing short of magnificent. Let me say right off the bat that if you did not hear Dr. Bill's lecture, address, whatever you wish to call it, of two nights ago, you missed a treat. All of these files will be going up at my page on White Rose Society, whiterosesociety.org. That's where all the archives live. And you know, if you've just got a lot of stuff to do where you'll have time for some listening. Maybe you got to go out and mow the South 40. You listening, Dennis? Load these lectures up with particular emphasis on the offerings of Dr. Tom Tierney, Dr. Bill O'Brien, and Dr. John Kaminsky. Because if you are equipped with what those three gentlemen have to offer, you are absolutely girded in such a way as that no teabagger will ever be able to withstand the onslaught of your factual arguments. The information is that good, that real. Now I'm sitting. We're in a classroom down at Concord College at the Nick Joe Ray Hall Technology Center there, and I'm up in the back corner. The room is packed. Every seat is filled and then some. Because I got to tell you, it's been a while since I've been in college, but apparently there's more of me than there was back in college. That, or else this relatively new building was designed for hobbits. And hobbits of no great girth. It's a little bit of a... But we're packed in there like sardines. It's good that the crowd is this big, because the idea that this kind of information is being made available, this kind of history analysis, this kind of actual skull sweat is being made available to more than 50 teachers of history in the secondary schools of Southern West Virginia is heartening, to say the least. I won't begin to try to condense or to summarize any of what has been said thus far. That's what the archives are for. And by the way,
There are also archives available for your viewing at our Ustream page. If you go to Ustream, that's the letter U followed by the word stream, ustream.tv, and simply search American History Seminar, bang, we will pop right up there. All been saved and annotated and noted and tagged and folded and spindled and mutilated. We've used no hooks. But they're all there for you. And if you will avail yourselves of them, you know, I've been saying this for months, and I hope some of you are checking this stuff out. Because I don't care how much American history, especially when it centers on the Revolution and the ratification of the Constitution and the philosophical underpinnings that gave rise to the urge for independence from Great Britain. And now we've moved into the 19th century. I don't care how much you think you know about it. You don't know what these people know. Did to you gratis. So do avail yourself of it. Agnes sits here monitoring the stream so she can text to me if I'm screwing up or something. Agnes has been sitting here watching and listening, and I get these texts every now and then, just, oh my God, Bob, I can't believe what I'm hearing. And Bob, this is amazing. This is like water to a person dying of thirst. And several other of you have written to me along these lines as well. I especially commend to you, as I noted, Dr. Bill's remarks from a couple of nights ago. It's something special. For those of you who have been listening to the Horn for a lot of years, and we've been around for a lot of years, we've outlasted a lot of other efforts. But to those of you who have listened for a lot of years, you may recall actually listening to Dr. Bill when he was on the Horn. It was a couple of the best hours of programming per day that the Horn has ever produced. And to listen to Dr. Bill as he gets into the meat of his subject, and to hear and to just listen patiently and absorb the information, and then wait as he comes all the way back around and tidies it all up and ties it all together in an absolutely stunning peroration. You're not going to hear that anywhere else. You are not going to hear that anywhere else. So I hope you will avail yourself of this material, because it is magic, it is magnificent, it is soaring, and it's not the same old usual stuff you hear about American history. This is the stuff that the people who really sit thinking about this stuff talk about when nobody's listening. Only we are. You get it when it all begins to sink in and you realize, well, how can I put this? Hearing the United States referred to as a democracy will never strike you the same way again. You know, that's a word that we like to bandy about a bit. I even heard it in a clip from Prime Minister's Question Time from the UK earlier today when I was doing prep, and I had gone over to Crooks and Liars. Something, blah, 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 our democracy, blah, blah, blah. No such thing. And when the doors open and the light comes, the curtains get pulled back, the light comes streaming in the windows, and you realize that we have the Constitution we have because a lot of people in those days were afraid that democracy was getting out of hand. That there was just way too much democracy that had to be reined in, that the money was getting nervous. Well, you begin to see the rise and growth of America in a different light. Not a bad light, just a different light. A more realistic light. And we are, after all, a member of the reality-based community, right? Just checking. So do avail yourself of this. And I want to share an email with you real quick right off the bat. Got an email from our buddy John. You've heard John a few times. John works, studies in the field of archaeology. I guess you would say he is the Horn's resident archaeologist. But he has a passion for history itself. And John wrote to me earlier this afternoon, and he said, "Hey, Bob, I've been catching the Prism series, and I am blown away by the quality of information that's being put out for free to anyone who tunes in. I think a worry is supremely important in this day and age when we have Bachman and others putting out fake historical information to suit their own twisted ends. When people are armed with facts and a critical perspective within which to apply them, we can spot right-wing revisionism when we see it. And that, says John, is vital." He continues, "So I'm thrilled with the Horn's commitment to broadcasting the Prism series, but I also realize that you're taking a financial hit by not being on the air every night. So I'd like to put out a contribution challenge for tonight's broadcast. I'll match your fundraising that comes in tonight up to the first $50. So if five people contribute $10 apiece, I'll contribute 50. If two people contribute 25 apiece, I'll contribute 50. The combination doesn't matter. Basically, I'll double the first I'm in. If you pull in $500 tonight, I'll still contribute $50. Limited resources, alas. Well, I understand. It's not much," says John, incorrectly. "Oh, it's a lot, believe me. But for those thinking about giving a small donation, now's the perfect time because your dollars will multiply." John closes saying, "Hope you and the family are doing well, and thanks again for your efforts on behalf of all of us." Thank you kindly, John. Thank you very, very much. Because what he says is true. It's the 8th day of July, and about $155 for the month of July. That and those were critical. Well, I couldn't have gotten back to Concord to continue the broadcast series without that. And right now we're kind of the gas to get there Sunday night. So John's offer at a remarkably good time. So five members of the Thrifty 250 get their contributions doubled by John and his kind matching offer. Now, off to the races. It is Friday on the front porch. If we were doing this outside, we really would be under the front porch because it's raining rather steadily outside. Not Donder and Blitzen, not Eppen or anything like that. Just a good, hard, steady summer's rain. The kind of stuff that sends gardeners and farmers out dancing in it. A soaking rain. Not the kind of stuff that just hits and runs off because it's coming down so hard, but the stuff that's sometimes referred to as a Scots mist. A soaking rain. So we would be under roof. So it's Friday on the front porch. And frankly, Appalachia, what's left of it, unspoiled and untormented, is beautiful in this kind of weather. Oh, it's wet, and everywhere you step it squishes. And the clouds seem to be just at treetop level. The fog itself becomes tangible and physical. And everything is shrouded in a sort of soft focus. So it's a lot of its sort here in one of the largest temperate rainforests on the planet. Now, I don't know what you've got on your mind about this evening. Everything is, well, everything but one thing is open to discussion. And I don't want to be an ass or anything, but would you do me a favor, please? Would none of you please And I don't think I've ever put this kind of a limitation on Friday on the front porch before. And I don't really think I need to mention this, but just for safety's sake, because I don't want to run screaming out into the rain tonight. Could we agree at the beginning of the program not to talk about the crazy... The fact that Nancy Grace has not been dragged out into the streets and caned evades me. Could we not talk about the Casey Anthony case? And having said that, I will say no more. Now, maybe you want to discuss the recent issue of whether or not President Not Sure has decided to put the lives and well-being of 30 million seniors on the bargaining table. Well, not really on the bargaining table, on the menu, if you will. Maybe you want to talk about that. Maybe you want to talk about the ongoing and burgeoning it's more than a scandal. It's a sickening conspiracy that has been that has had the lid pulled off of it in the United Kingdom with regard to Rupert Murdoch. Maybe you want to discuss that, and I think that is would be very, very good for us so to do. But before we get started, I got one thing that I want to go to because, well, damn it, it pisses me off. And I want you to have it at hand just so you can understand a little bit about the world that Appalachian people live in. There it goes again. Now, you want to hear this. I told you, I've mentioned repeatedly this recent health study that says the nearer one gets to a mountaintop removal operation, the greater the likelihood becomes that one's children will be born deformed and with various and sundry, six different categories, really, of birth defects. Well, there's a long history of denying the toxic hell that coal has unleashed on Appalachia. You know, in the grand scheme of things, I can't help thinking that as my forebears were stealing the lands here from the native peoples who occupied it peacefully, well, mostly, they fought over it some, too. After all, the Iroquois Confederacy sold it to the Virginians, saying, oh, yeah, we've conquered everybody down there. There's nobody really there. No. Go ahead, take it. When the whole time the Shawnee were here and they go, wait! We don't even like those people. So, yeah. But anyway, my people came in and stole the land. And it reminds me of the shortest poem that Robert Frost ever wrote. It's a poem called Forgive, O Lord. And we all know that my Scots forebears were very, very pious people. There's an old saying that the Scots landed in America and fell on their knees and prayed to God and then fell on the natives and prayed on them. It's pretty much true. There's another old saying that the Scots feared God so much they had no room left to fear anyone else. Equally so. But this poem by Robert Frost says, Forgive, O Lord, my little jokes on thee, and I'll forgive thy great big one on me. It is a sort of recognition of one of those theses that runs the length and breadth of this. Be an almighty God, and almighty God be not some imaginary hallucination collective on the part of the human species. That if there be such a thing, he is a god of irony. It is a god of irony. She is a god. Animals recognize this in their creation or their veneration of coyote god, who was a trickster. But with all that going as prologue, I can't help thinking that there was a little chuckle going on, cosmically, metaphysically, as my forebears dispossessed people who lived on the earth and didn't scrabble a bunch in it, unleashing all the reasons that lived underneath these Appalachian mountains. Oh, Oh, yeah, go ahead and steal that land. Do it. Oh, just do it. Go ahead. Yeah, because I tell you what, I'm going to unleash some shit on you. And it has happened. If you live near a mountaintop removal operation in Appalachia, your children have a 42% greater likelihood of being born with a variety of some 6 different birth defects. Brought to you by the coal industry. It keeps the lights on in funeral homes. But going back to the earliest days when coal miners would come out of the dusky, dusty, filthy, dank, damp, toxic environs of underground coal mines, coughing and spitting up blood, and eventually discovered to be black lung disease. Coal miners' pneumoconiosis is the formal term. The coal company said, "Nah, ain't no such a thing. We're good, honorable businessmen. We're just digging up the coal that's keeping the Industrial Revolution a turning and a going." They denied black lung even existed. Ah, them's all smokers. They smoke, everybody. You know, the coal industry was the first industry ever to suggest that cigarette smoking was bad for you, but they only did it to evade their own responsibility for killing people with coal dust. Coal dust is bad for you. It's tough. It's terminal. So, flash forward, and we get this new study regarding birth defects near mountaintop removal operations. At first, the coal industry said, "Well, you know, we ain't had a chance to study it up enough yet. We ain't studied on it. We ain't got the checks out to our own paid little prostitute researchers who'll blame it on something else. We ain't ready to comment yet." But, you know, that's probably not true. That's how them liberals are. All the time trying to make up stuff that gets in the way of business in America. It ain't real. Well, they've outdone themselves. Earlier this evening, when I was outside getting in the rusty red pickup truck to toddle down into town, as is my wont before showtime, just to sort of walk around, blow, you know, that kind of thing, I looked around at those skies that were hanging at treetop level, as I mentioned. It's beautiful. And I thought, well, it's not really gorillas in the mist here in central Appalachia, but apparently, as far as the National Mining Association is concerned, it's something close. Hillbillies in the mist. Now, like I said, we're going to have plenty of time to talk about whether or not Barack Obama has put a lot of us on the menu, or whether he's playing us. We'll have time to talk about Rupert Murdoch and any number of the myriad stories I missed in my absence. But this one, I got to get this one out front just so you can know what we're dealing with here, what kind of an outlaw, sleazy, slimy, filthy, disgusting bunch we're talking about in the form of the coal industry, and in this case, the National Mining Association. It's been a couple of weeks now since the story came out, and I guess the coal industry has had a chance to have a look at it. And in response to the fact that mountaintop removal causes a 42% greater likelihood of a wide variety of birth defects in children born in Appalachia, well, the coal industry's looked around for a loophole. And by God, they think they found it. Sit down. No, really, sit down. You're going to love this. The National Mining Association has now criticized the study, the birth defect study, and shown its invalidity as follows. Yeah, just so you can, just to remind you of what music's playing there. You know what's coming, don't you? This is a quote. This is a real quote. Boy, howdy, would I like to find the author of this here quote. I'd like to find him about 2:30 in the morning, stumbling out of a bar somewhere in, I don't know, Georgetown. The National Mining Association has announced that the birth defect study is flawed. No, really, is flawed, because why? Well, like I said, this is a quote. The birth defect study is flawed, according to the National Mining Association, because, and I quote, the study failed to account for consanguinity. Now, that's a $10 word for incest. You know, you're my sister. You're my sister. I'm your brother. I'm your brother. Hoo-wee! The study failed to account for any of the most prominent sources of... That's right! The National Mining Association just said every hillbilly with a deformed birth baby has that deformed baby because we're a bunch of inbred goddamn hillbillies who don't have enough common sense not to get it on with the relations. You know how it is. Deeper kin, closer in. Closer kin, deeper in, something like that. Y'all come back now, you hear? And clean up your mess. Now, doesn't that just kind of take your breath away? I mean, how's that for some straight-up gall? And guess what? Every elected representative by now on board with this quote. The study failed to account for consanguinity, one of the most prominent sources of birth defects. Well, damn. That's it. Just incest. That's why. You know how it goes. All those vascular birth defects, all those cardio birth defects, all those pulmonary birth defects, endocrine birth defects, all those brain birth defects. It's just incest. It's because Jethro couldn't keep off of Ellie Mae. And there he was, a rutting on my mailer. Dang, you know. Just dang. So I hope you can understand why I delayed by a couple of minutes our discussion, whether or not we're on the menu. We are. And whether or not Rupert Murdoch is a sleazy slimeball who should be dragged into the street and caned. Because he is. I hope you can... Because, you know, we tell jokes on ourselves here in Appalachia. But I'm damned if we much care for having others offer them up as serious fact. It don't play well. It's kindly sick, if you know what I mean. Yep. It's all... I thought so. Pardon me for just a minute, lest we have some kitty engineering here. Sit on my lap, Mooshu. You'll be going back in the house later, as soon as we take a break. Which we're going to do. I want to make... as they've rolled in. First of all, we are $30 toward John's $50 challenge. And News Ninja Susan sent in a note. She said, I'll add to that challenge up to an additional $100. Bless your heart, Susan. Thank you. Didn't need to do that. So now it is on. If we can bring in $150, it'll turn into $300. Now that's making your money work. So there you have it. And I hope you'll pardon my my little bit of frustration at being called an inbred hillbilly by the National Mining Association. By God, if we had a few million listeners here, we'd have letters going out to the National Mining Association saying, why hadn't that dirty little son of a bitch that wrote that been fired yet? I mean, my God, they called their own workers a bunch of inbred hillbillies. Get at every birth defect in Appalachia to inbredness, to inbreeding. Right? Yeah. No, that's not an audio defect you're hearing there. That's a cat that's very happy to see me home. She's decided she's going to be a stole this evening. She's around my neck. So we got to take a break. We'll come back to your phone calls 28 minutes before the hour. This, America's listener-supported liberal voice, this is The Horn.
By the time you were born, there were four other siblings, with your mama waiting, your daddy in jail, and your oldest brother was away at a home. And you didn't meet him till you were old. Old enough to know better. Old enough to know better. But you took to his jawline, long sandy hair. And he made you feel like none of the others. And the way he looked at you touched you deep down in the So you jumped up and rolled into the sunset, but the sequel, it started with the next morning sun. And they flew on the bike seat, and you all aglow from the love he put in you and a life on the run. So you moved to a small town, and then to another, and then to another on his way. And you both keep it together, and the state wouldn't take your babies away. Now the district attorney said he might have forgiven, had lots of reasons to turn out this. But you both go to jail for them four little babies made and delivered along the way.
Patron saint band of the horn, that is the and well, forgive my macabre sense of humor, but you know that little dedication, the deeper in, goes out to the National Mining Association, who thinks that everybody who lives in Appalachia is an inbred hick. Nice people that. Okay, so enough. That's enough of me. It is Friday on the Front Porch, and let's go straightways to the phone. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Brother Bob.
Brother Albert.
Buddy.
Ah, now, doing okay?
I don't know, that kid Ferg looks a lot like you. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, but he looks a lot like Agnes, too, so that, you know, that's a good thing.
I like her, too. What's going on? Unbelievable.
How will the National Mining Association ever explain that, Brother Albert?
They're so filthy. They never end. You know, I just got back from our little trip that we took with the family to New York, did the museum, and I'll get to all that in a second. But on the way back, I saw a sign that almost gave me about 2 hours of rage and fury. I didn't even need to drink one of those five-hour energy drinks. This is on the way back through Pennsylvania. It said, "The wind dies, the sun sets. Coal keeps the lights on."
No.
Yeah. I mean, it was the only one I saw, so...
No, where? What, no, again, where?
In Pennsylvania, like in the heart of it.
Oh,
yeah. So I was like, here they come, advertising up here. You Amish boys want jobs? There's probably a few mountains up there with a layer or two in there, maybe, you think?
Yeah, we could longwall it, or... contour mine it. That's another one of their fun lists for mountaintop removal. Contour mining.
Yeah.
Yeesh.
Yeah, they are filthy. And though you
I can just see. I can just see Hiram and Lemuel on those D9 caterpillars now.
Well, yeah, boy.
And I'm sure the National Mining Association wouldn't. When it gets there. The National Mining Association will be more than happy to trot and say, "Well, I mean, my God, look who—it's the Amish."
Exactly. I mean, well, you know, that's if these liberals—they keep, you know, trying to put regulations on fuel. You know, maybe we'd be able to turn coal to fuel. We wouldn't need horse and buggies and all that stuff. You know,
just spoiling all their fun.
Filthy liberals. Anyway, yeah, they're disgusting. These people, I can't take it anymore. I did take the girls, Little Troopers. We did about 85% of the Museum of Natural History. Not a whole lot of whining, a lot of enthusiasm. It was a good thing.
They had to be thrilled inside that building.
Oh, yeah. It was really cool, too, because we had taken them down to the water.
Rocks, right?
Oh, yeah, there was horseshoe crabs. They're in their season to mate, so you see them, you know. And I say to them, they're like, "What is that?" I'm like, "Oh, that's an ancient creature called the horseshoe crab." Now, horseshoe crab didn't stick, but ancient creature did. So when they saw them embedded in the rock, the ancient creature! You know, so that worked.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was pretty fun. They had an absolute blast. We took them to the Tenement Museum. So if anyone's in New York, we're all immigrants here, right? Aren't we in this country? You gotta go to the Tenement Museum. You gotta take your kids. It's an amazing place. It's just an amazing place. It's just unbelievable. Where you get to see what it looks like in 1916 and how it feels and so on and so forth. If you're gonna go to Ellis Island or anything, if that interests you, you definitely must do the Tenement Museum. Anyhow, here's the thing that bugged me about the Museum of Natural History. It was a great place. There were some replicas. That was a little bit of annoyance. One thing that really just got to me though, was, you know, like every one now and then, in a little corner here or there, you'd see a sticker in a dark corner with no light on it. You'd look around, wouldn't be like even pointing to it. It wouldn't just be talking about species and extinction. There was a brass on the floor, and there was a light on that on the floor. And so it would talk about in the sixth extinction. And then you walk up to the Margaret Mead exhibit, right? And there's just bunches of people up at the Islanders, and in the back is a Moai, you know, from Easter Island, Rapa Nui, place we've talked about many, many times.
That little laboratory experiment for what we're doing to the planet right now.
Amen. This is why I love you, Brother Bob. You know this instantaneously, and I'd like to at least look and see what they have. Not a mention of what and why and where they went and what they turned into. Nothing, not even a peep. So I had to make sure. My twins are apart. One of them was with my dad, who was up in the front, and the other one was with Renee, and they were kind of lollygagging in the back, you know, the reed maps of the Native Americans in the exhibit right before. So Yeah, it took them a while. But once I got, I think it was Reyes, it was the first one, I made sure I explained to her, in the front of the crowd of all these posing tourists, loudly enough so they would hear it, that how they are an example of what not to do, of how not to treat the planet, because literally they couldn't stop carving these frickin' things, and they wind up destroying their entire environment, and they went pretty much extinct until what, Cook or one of those dudes found them and, you know.
Well, yeah, and there's that period between when the last tree falls and white folks show up, and that's when the fun's really going down, Albert, because that's when, you know, because there was a combination of stuff, you know, rats. And so rats went on the, when the last tree went, you know, rats went on the menu. And when they got most of the rats out, guess what went on the menu next? Yeah, Fred and Wilma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you've got all that lovely cannibalism going on, and, oh, sure. It's, yeah, and.
We're down to 3,000 when they arrived. 3,000. And they were eating each other. They were just about done. Another 100 years, and there wouldn't be any of them left. And, you know, and so there wasn't a man. I had to write an email regarding these things. You know, like, I had to, and I asked the curator, whoever the damn thing went to, probably some poor Haitian woman, you know, who doesn't speak English or in some dusty corner of the basement. But I sat down and I had to ask him, is extinction important? Because, I mean, if it is, why are you so afraid to educate people about that we're going into it? You know, I understand everyone wants to take a, you know, this is a vacation, but, you know, like, these are the hallowed halls of human history. And why, you're not there for Mickey Mouse and other nonsense. You're there to be, you know, to be enlightened, to actually look at these things and see, you know, and for where we all know, but we know where the past is, where we can go in the future. Unless we decide to steer in a different direction.
Well, I'm just curious. I got to ask one question because you asked the question. Why aren't we telling people about extinction? Anywhere in the Museum of Natural History, there in beautiful New York City, did you happen to see any brochure brought to you with a generous contribution from Georgia Pacific or Shell Oil or BP or GE? Because you know that stuff doesn't just buy shelves to put skulls on. That stuff buys silence too.
I didn't quite, and I'm pretty sure in that museum, I really didn't see any of that, which is decent, but that is something that well could be. They might not just put it on the stand. They haven't updated a lot of those things since, you know, a long time ago, I mean. So, you know, that could very well, you just have to go look on the Board of Trustees or whatever on it, you know, now, and you'd probably see how clear it is.
Well, it's kind of sad that we have to do that sort of thing. But really, I think in order to be informed now, we kind of do have to sort of have to do that thing.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll tell you right now, I mean, I just kind of got back, and we finally kind of woke up, you know how a trip like that.
I got back on the road almost immediately after getting back here from Netroots Nation. I might be okay somewhere out in early September. but we gotta be cognizant of that sort of stuff, Albert, because, I mean, for instance, the Koch brothers, God, I hate them, the Koch brothers, and one in particular, the one that looks like Michael Caine. I don't know which Koch brother that is, but there's a Koch brother who looks a lot like Michael Caine, especially from Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, or maybe Get Carter. In both instances, they're, you know, crooks.
Yes.
But he's a big patron of the New York Metropolitan Opera or the New York City Ballet or one of those, you know, highfalutin things where people stand around with cups of tea with their little fingers sticking out. You know, he's a genuine patron of the arts. And, of course, being cash-strapped artistic organizations, they would take money from the devil himself.
Yes.
But the other thing is, I doubt you will be seeing Rapa Nui, the opera, at the Met because of the Coke money. And you won't see Ballet of the Last Rat at the New Ballet because of the Coke brothers. Because, you know, one of the filthy things about money is that it has the power to pervert almost everything.
Exactly. In fact, we were I did get to visit the hallowed ground of Tesla's tower. And so that, because that was, you know, as I told you, it was right down the road from us. But we had visiting this, because the Port Jefferson was where I grew up, was they used to build ships there. There's a couple little things like that. So we were at one of these museums, and this guy starts talking to me about, you know, this and that, and I talked about Tesla, and he knew about Tesla. It was, you know, one of those good things. But then he talked about, we started getting into health insurance, because this place was, they had a doctor's office attached to it, and he had said to me something about Obamacare, you know, something about, oh, Obama, and I got interrupted by the lady, and I said it again. See, now, this is, I guess, you know, my philosophy, that we, you know, democracy is here in the street, not in the government. We have a representative government. Just, that's just kind of how I approach this country. So he said this. I'm like, well, you know, the real problem with Obama is he's trying to make everyone happy. To that, he agreed. Then he started to talk about it and the insurance company, but, you know, and then we, of course, we got to talk about insurance. Preempt with, hey, these guys need billion-dollar retirement packages when they're done at 7 years old. No. And back to the money. I've never run into anybody who's ever disagreed, and I'm sure they exist, but I personally have not ever had anyone to my face tell me that. And if they even kind of look like they have a glint in their eye, then I should, then, you know, I preempt with, should I be allowed an atomic weapon in my basement? Of course, right, because there's so much power. And then, you know, it's the kind of things that we have to educate, you know, right now, Tuesday is when we look to recall one of these slimy, disgusting Republican state senators that has enabled this mask removal. I should think of my getting them, get the hell out of office. But, you know, we got the recall on Tuesday, and there are, you know, tons of people. And you've seen the neighborhood. How many billionaires live in this city of this little tiny town?
Yeah, I'm thinking none.
Yeah. I mean, how many of these guys, I mean, even in the next town over, I wonder how many billionaires are there. Because there are none. I live in the poorest county of Wisconsin. It's all little farms and little farmettes and things like that. You know, and then we make a couple things. We only have a couple businesses, mostly organic food. That's really like the big, you know, money maker in this community. Oh, and there's the Indian casinos right there on sovereign land. So, but that's it. So, when I see my neighbors with panty signs, it's outrageous to me that you would imagine that you could sit there and align yourself with that mindset. But, hey, Michelle Bachmann's got sex appeal, right? Right?
Oh, not, well, I...
Yeah. Oh, no. She's
no, I think the likes of she... I think the likes of she and Godzilla from Wasilla call into question the sexual preferences, and I don't mean straight versus gay. I mean the sexual preferences of a lot of right-wing heterosexual men. Because how that gets to be sexy, sorry, dunno.
Yeah, and I'll tell you that there is really no.
I mean, did you see that story? I mean, we've all kind of wondered, Albert, about, you know, that woman got through law school, really? And I don't know if you saw it or not, but there's a story now out that explains all this. Her husband made her go to law school because he's the head of the family, and she has to be submissive to him. And so he made her go to law school to be a tax lawyer, I guess so he wouldn't have to pay an accountant. Because he's a psychologist who sucks at the federal teat. Why, at the same time that his wife is out there doing all she can to kill Medicare and Medicaid.
Interesting.
I can't fathom it. But then again, there's a lot I can't fathom about her. There's and I guess it's okay to talk about her because she's actually running for president as opposed to that poser.
Mm-hmm.
She's running for president. You know, she wants to live in John Wayne Gacy's America, she told us. and she said something that just kind of, she said she hopes that higher unemployment will help her presidential campaign.
Oh, yeah. It's
I'm back.
Yeah, did you miss me?
Futurama, you know, Nixon's head in a jar. But the thing is, he'd be a liberal compared to her.
Yeah. Well, I'd vote for Nixon over any of these crazies. In a heartbeat. Who wouldn't? How could you not? You know, well, I mean, yeah, right, he was a scumbag. But compared to these people? It's not even close. It's not even close. It's not even close. These people are, I mean, he was just, you know, that where he is. God, these people are ridiculous. It's so ridiculous. I can't even imagine, I can't even believe anyone even listens to them, right? The other thing is, that the biggest problem is that when you talk to their supporters, they're just immune to common sense. They're just ignorant. I encourage you at least to...
I mean, I was wandering around over at BartCop today, just, you know, checking stuff out, seeing what's going to, you know, because, you know, I've been reading BartCop since God was a baby. And I guess the big thing at teabagger parties these days and celebrations and festivals and things like that, they're selling T-shirts, not kidding, Albert, that say, "Yep, I'm a racist." Wow.
Yeah, we, duh. Yeah. You should have heard it there. Of course they're racist. You should have heard the comments about Obama taking the guns. No, he doesn't want to take the guns. He wants to close the gun, that gun show loophole, you know, take away guns from people. And, you know, guns like felons who could just walk into a gun show. Oh, I like that.
Or Al-Qaeda terrorists who could also just walk into a gun show. That's a mighty long beard there, brother. Oh, I'm Amish. Back to the Amish again. Sorry, not beating on him, but...
Yeah. He's in a turtleneck. Yeah. You're not Arab, aren't you, boy? No, I'm not, sir. I'm Indian. Oh, okay. I mean, you know, like Gandhi. You know, they like this look like they, you know, like, oh,
yeah.
What would you do with this gun if I shoot that gun in the head? Bring on! $50 off! And you gotta, you know, that's how it is. I mean, who's jugging it? It's private mail. They don't have to do anything. And I love how they act like there's no gun show loophole. It's all those people that do that. Probably guys that go down there and sell 500 weapons. You got a license? I got a license.
I've been to gun shows in West Virginia. There's a gun show loophole. Trust me. I could give $200 to a 5-year-old and he could put it on the. Well, son, you look a little short grown up. Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, here's your Glock 9mm and here's your 32 round banana clip for it. Happy target shooting.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, they of course when you know Obama says they're talking about removing these clips from handguns and so forth, you know, all the things that got always trying to arm that there is an acorn. That's real. I can't make that crap up.
I know.
That's why it's just like, huh? What the fuck? What one? You guys just don't stop. Planned Parenthood. They're planning an assault. Call up General Bachman. I mean, they're just ridiculous. And I'll tell you another thing that was really nice to hear. I only, cause, you know, I just got home, so I'm better up. The prism, I told you, it's on my list. The minute I hang up with you, that's what I'm doing for the rest of the day. Children, be quiet. Daddy's learning. So.
What a line. Daddy's learning.
Daddy's reading. What you reading for, Daddy? Anyway, you know, so.
Peace be upon him.